I was crying with pain as I held my grip on the antler. The deer's breathing was labored and angry, yet the boat moved with him in the fog. Jordan was still saying a rosary that had no beginning or end when the boat hit land, and the deer dragged me off the bow of the boat and deposited me into the black earth of the marsh and Spartina. We had landed on Cumberland Island, Georgia, after 15 days at sea. Jordan Elliott dragged himself out of the marsh and flagged down a forest ranger in a jeep who called the Coast Guard, and we were flown by helicopter to Savannah, Georgia. The doctors said that both Capers and Mike would have died sometime in the next 24 hours, and that it was a miracle that any of us survived the ordeal. On the second night in the hospital, Jordan walked over to my bed, carrying his IV with him. "A riddle, Jack. I don't feel like playing any more games," I said. "This one has great implications, cosmic ones," said Jordan. "Is it a joke?" "No, it's the most serious thing in the world," Jordan said. "Go ahead, I can't stop you." "Where did we encounter God out there, Jack? Which one was God?" "I don't know what you're talking about," I said. "Get away from me." "Was it the blue marlin or the manta ray? Or was he in the fish we caught to survive, like the loaves and the fishes? Or was it the hammerhead, the storm, or the white-tailed buck?" "Do I get to choose none of the above?" I asked, disturbed. "God was all of them," Jordan explained. "He came to us in different forms. He loved us and wanted to look out for us." "He did a piss-poor job," I said. "A great job," Jordan said. "We're all alive." "How do you know this, about God, I mean, appearing as those animals?" "I asked Mary, his mother," Jordan said. "You always have to go to the source." Part 5, Chapter 32. Through no preference or selection of our own, the graduating class of 1966, in high schools all over America, found ourselves cast like dice across the velvet-covered gambling tables of history. There were no signposts or catechisms or rules of the road to help us navigate through the weary maze of the 60s. We were shot out indiscriminately into the trickery of the slippery, rampaging decade, and the best we could do was cover our eyes and ears and genitalia like pangolins or armadillos, and make sure that our soft underbellies were not exposed for either inspection or slaughter. The class of 1966 was entering an America that was newly hallucinatory and disfigured. The whole country seemed to have turned inward upon itself, and all the old certainties seemed marginal and hollow, and that tangy confidence of a nation accustomed to strutting turned hesitant almost overnight. As our footsteps echoed across the stage, this class entered a country that was traveling incognito even to itself. We would become part of the first American generation of this century to wage war on each other. The Vietnam War would be the only foreign war ever fought on American soil. All were free to choose sides. Bystanders were ridiculed and not tolerated. There were no survivors in the 60s, only casualties and prisoners of war and veterans who cried out in the dark. Though I still consider the 60s the silliest and stupidest of times, I will admit, under pressure, that some of it was wonderful, even magnificent. I felt acutely, transcendently alive then, while none of the succeeding decades has made me feel a single thing. But I did not think I would have ever recognized the boy I had turned into back then. I was not even certain that the college boy, Jack McCall, would slow down to shake hands with the man he was required to turn into after all the smoke had cleared. I had loved the University of South Carolina. My escape from my father's house seemed an emancipation of spirit beyond any price or measure. My father could no longer humiliate me because I was simply unavailable, no longer inhabiting the same house. Each day, my teachers forced me to pay attention to the written works of writers I had not yet heard of. I discovered to my joy that these anonymous men and women who had practiced their secret wizardry with the English language long before I was born wrote exquisitely. It surprised me when I read Chaucer in Old English and found him to be a most hilarious writer. I had not even imagined that people laughed and kidded around in medieval England. In my innocence, I assumed that laughter itself was a modern innovation and held no place in the destinies of charwomen and longbowmen of years past. Drifting through books, I found the pleasures of discovery to be an almost daily occurrence. My first 2 years of college were quiescent, exhilarating, busy. The immensity of the university, the anonymity of that unruly, self-governing city-state, operating in full view of the state capital, provided me a bright glimpse of a world as rife with possibility, and those prodigal chances, open-ended and acute, that a boy with nerve could run away with to the end of the earth. Ideas refreshed and overwhelmed me, as though some moon within me was perpetually full, and the tide always high. While other colleges in America seethed and boiled during the nationwide debate on the Vietnam War, we students of the University of South Carolina drank. We drank bathtubs full of a ghastly concoction called Purple Jesus, composed of unfermented grape juice and cheap vodka. Silver kegs of beer, enthroned in melting pools of ice, sat in royal attendance at every student event. Drunkenness was a condition of choice among a high percentage of the student body, and a studied, self-conscious state of irony and cool was the most highly prized attitude among the males, preening and fanning their tail feathers for the edification of the highly selective coeds. The Greek system was paramount and unchallenged in its authority over all aspects of campus life when our freshman class arrived at Carolina. The only Greek that I had ever learned was in that first year, when I tried to distinguish among the bewildering array of fraternities and sororities, whose names caused confusion and dissension among the ranks of freshmen. Capers confided in me during the first month that one's choice of a fraternity was the most significant selection a man would make before his engagement to a proper young woman. He told me that 5 former KAs and 6 former SAEs had written flattering letters of reference for him, which both chapters had received the previous summer. From Ladea, I learned that 3 of her mother's sorority sisters had written letters on her behalf, but the fact that her mother herself was a tri-delt from Carolina took much of the guesswork out of her fate. As a legacy, Ladea confessed, she was practically a shoo-in through no achievement of her own. I attended most of the parties the fraternities gave, and caught an infinitesimal glimpse of a social milieu I had heard rumor of, but had never quite understood because of its subtlety. Ladea had broken up with me after high school graduation, because she was coming upon her debutante season, and my family and I did not quite cut the mustard among those committees that passed judgment on the desirability and entitlement of both the debutantes and their beau. Since my father was a judge and a member of the bar, and his mother was a Sinclair from Charleston, I'd always assumed that my bloodline was passable, if not sublime. I never fully understood the depth of the mismatch my father had made when he had married my raw, unlettered mother. Nor could my mother help me navigate these perilous shallows. I understood neither the code nor the uniform of fraternity life, and both were something that a young man needed drilled into his psyche long before rush week. Everything that was right about me in high school was wrong for the best fraternities. I was a quick study and could take the temperature of a room like a column of mercury, so I felt my otherness instantly as I watched the painfully cordial brothers assess me from head to foot. In early August, I had received another surprising lesson in the mysterious social ethic that my friends seemed so at ease with. I had accompanied Capers and the imperious Mrs. Middleton on a shopping expedition to Berlin's in Charleston, to purchase the proper clothing for Capers during that all-important first year. "Remember," Eulalia Middleton said, "the first impression is the only impression that counts. And," she said, stretching the word out for emphasis, "the only one that lasts." "So true, so true," said Mr. Berlin, helping Capers into a blue blazer. "Rapping is what turns a common present into a treasure," she intoned, as Capers studied himself in a black, pinstriped suit. "You should write a book, Mrs. Middleton," Mr. Berlin said, making chalk marks on the cuffs of the rolled-up pants. "Though these things seem obvious to us, you'd be appalled by some of the things I hear in this store." "It's all just common sense, and," she said, arching her eyebrows and catching my eye in the mirror, "good taste is just something one is born with or not." When Capers bought a tuxedo that afternoon, I learned that one could actually purchase a tuxedo and not merely rent one for the night. When Capus's bill was added up, it came to over $3,000, and I whistled in amazement, then realized I had committed an unrecallable social gaffe, as I saw Capus, Mrs. Middleton, and Mr. Boleyn go to great pains to pretend they had not heard it. Making up figures in my head, I wondered if my parents had spent $3,000 on me during my entire life, and that counted food. But I was dazzled by the care that Capus and his mother took in the well-considered selection of his college wardrobe. When Capus was trying on a beautifully cut London Fog raincoat, I had gasped at the price and said, "What do you need that for, Capus?" Mrs. Middleton looked quizzical, then said, "Do you think that it doesn't rain in the upper portions of the state?" "Sure," I said, "but you can always duck inside somewhere, run home." "A gentleman doesn't duck anywhere," Mrs. Middleton explained, "and a gentleman is prepared for all exigencies of weather. You'll need a black umbrella to walk young ladies back to their sorority houses in the rain, Capus. What on earth will you do about those young ladies, Jack?"
"Guess I'll grab their hand and tell them to run for it with me."
"Indeed," said Mrs. Middleton, but I saw Mr. Boleyn suppressing a smile. Though I tried to assimilate all the protocols of college life in my off-key first semester, there was too much detail to process in such a short time. I was too self-conscious and disheveled to make a perfect fit into the complex pecking order of the best fraternities. I watched the stir that followed Capers's entrance into a fraternity mixer and realized that it was something far more mysterious than London fog that made these potential brothers lukewarm and non-committal when I trailed like a pilot fish behind Capers from party to party. The courtesies were all observed to the letter, yet I could feel my appearance creating almost no disturbances as I drifted from house to house in search of that perfect comfort zone that would tell me subliminally that I had come at last to the right place. Though no one told me straight out, I became aware that I was not even remotely desirable to the top-ranked fraternities on campus, and was at best a low- to mid-list candidate in the second-rate fraternities. Their surgery was done wordlessly and without anesthesia. Long before the fraternities made their final choices, I knew I was not in the running, and I told all my friends from high school that I had decided to be an independent. Many years later, I would admit to myself that my fierce championing of the anti-war movement would have been unnecessary if Sigma Alpha Epsilon could have gotten beyond my mail-order catalog attire and the towering, unsettling rawness of my entrance into parties. The aura of the small town still clung to me. The cheap scent of the backwater followed my silent wanderings as I tried my best to find my own niche on the Carolina campus. I had expected to spend most of my time with my best friends from Waterford and simply add dazzling names to that list as we entered into each and every phase of campus life. It troubled me, then displeased me, that Capers and Ladere were taken out of circulation with friends like me as soon as they arrived on campus. While fraternities were courting Capers with an internecine ferocity, the sororities had practically gone to war to win Ladere's approval. Mike had joined forces with the ZBTs, the Jewish fraternity, from the day he entered Carolina, on the run and on the move. He was foresighted and clear-thinking, and he knew where he was going. He had wanted to work in the movie industry since he was in high school, but he had to make his way toward filmdom. Though he majored in business administration, Mike immediately began to take every course the English department offered that had anything at all to do with film. He also went to the movies every day and made careful notes about what he thought about each and every film he saw. Whenever the lights went out in a movie theater and the credits began to roll on a huge screen, Mike was a perfectly happy man. College life fully engaged him with its extraordinarily busy social life, the seriousness of its academic coursework, and the opportunity that it provided an ambitious boy like Mike to extend his horizons as far as his wit and depth could take him. Since he had come from a family that deeply loved him, Mike assumed that everyone he met would surrender to his basic good nature, and almost everyone did. His smile was infectious and sprang out of his generous yet inquisitional nature. He wanted to know the life story of everyone he passed, and he had time to talk to anyone. He had a small genius for drawing out shy people and bringing them along as observers and cheerleaders in his fast-talking, pixelated world. On campus, he became famous for carrying an 8mm camera everywhere he went.
his skill with the camera slowly turned to a kind of artistry. At the university, only Shyla seemed to remain unchanged in the heady atmospherics of college life. None of the vainglory and maneuvering among the co-eds seemed of any interest to her at all. Since she was the prettiest Jewish girl on campus, and seemed to grow prettier every day, from the moment she set foot into her room in Capstone House, she dated a whole series of the most desirable and attractive Jewish boys on campus, including the president of ZBT. She joined the newspaper staff of the Gamecock her first week and won a minor part in the first theatrical production of the young season in Timon of Athens. Nothing about her seemed changed or forced or derivative, and whenever I saw her, I could turn a page backward in my life and see where I had once been by merely gauging her reaction to me. Though Shyla had dared me to fall in love with her the summer before when we danced in the Middletons' doomed beach house, she knew that I was not yet ready. She was patient and serene and confident that our history in the oak tree would eventually bring me to her. We often met for lunch in the Russell House and continued our childhood habit of telling each other everything. The one thing both of us agreed on was how much we missed Jordan and wished he had matriculated at the university instead of following in his father's footsteps to the Citadel. Neither of us thought the free-spirited Jordan would blossom in the Citadel's brutal trial by fire for its 600 plebes. Jordan's first letters began to arrive soon after the ordeal of plebe week was over and classes began. Under the cover of taking notes for his American history class, he wrote long diatribes about the indignities he and the other freshmen were forced to endure under the ungoverned rule of young sadists. I wrote my mother a letter and thanked her for sending me to this wonderful hellhole. I reminded her that this is the same school that produced that wonderful sport she married, and that some of these guys were actually making me miss my father. I've got this first sergeant named Bell, who has taken a particular dislike to yours truly, because he thinks the expression on my face reflects a bad attitude. Bell has the IQ of a tater tot, and has no idea how bad my attitude is, nor how bad I plan for it to become. I came here because my old man hates the fact that I'm alive and going around claiming to be his natural-born son. This whole thing's a bad idea. My roommate loves all this, and his ambition's to be a sniper in Vietnam. It's like rooming with Heinrich Himmler. Ask Shyla and Ladere if they'll put hickeys all over my neck when they see me. Oh, but I neglected to tell you about the rich, intellectual life at the Citadel. They showed the freshmen a stag movie last night where a woman makes love to a donkey. Believe me, both of us would have chosen the donkey. And my roommate, bless his fascist heart, is very proud of his ability to fart on command. He has shared this prized piece of information with his squad sergeant, and he now farts loudly and happily whenever called upon to strut his stuff. If I thought about how much I miss all of you, I couldn't last another 15 minutes here. Can you drive down to see me on my first leave? Yours truly, in torture and pain, Jordan. When Jordan marched in his first dress parade, Shyla and I drove down on a Friday afternoon to take him to dinner at the Colony House. Before the upperclassmen let Jordan and his classmates leave the barracks, they conducted an impromptu sweat party where Jordan was required to perform over 100 push-ups before he could sign out at the main sallyport. When he came out to meet us, his head shaved, we saw that he had lost a great deal of weight. "Why are you so skinny?" Shyla demanded to know. "My first sergeant doesn't believe that animals and plants should die just to let a dumbhead live," Jordan said. His mother taught him not to waste food, and feeding a knob is, by definition, wasting food. "Is this school teaching you anything?" I asked. "What are you majoring in?" "Spitshine." "No, really," Shyla said, laughing. "What's your field of study?" "Hand grenades with a minor in flamethrowers." We spent the night teasing and joking, but Jordan could not hide the deep sadness that provided both text and color for every story he told about life in the barracks. Another boy's face was so disfigured by acne, they forced him to wear a paper bag over his head at mess. A freshman from Waycross, Georgia, who had grown up poaching alligators in the black silences of the Okefenokee Swamp, had a nervous breakdown in physics class. What was getting to Jordan was the suffering of others. Long ago, he had grown accustomed to his own suffering. The cruelty he faced from the upperclassmen seemed buoyant and lightweight compared to his father's far more studied tyranny. Almost alone among the freshmen, Jordan found the mean-spiritedness of boys almost comical. What he did find disheartening was that the Citadel seemed to represent an institutional mimicry of his father's dark spirit. Before we even ordered, Jordan had eaten the whole loaf of freshly baked bread and a whole stick of butter that the waiter had brought with our menus. He also put 4 lumps of sugar into his iced tea and apologized profusely to his dinner companions. "I'm hungry enough to eat the crotch out of a rag doll," Jordan said.
"Jordan," Shyla warned.
"Oh, sorry, Shyla, I heard that at mess. No cadet can finish a sentence without using the word fuck at least once." "I thought I liked Carolina," I admitted, "until I saw your place. Now I know I'm ecstatic."
"Jack's having a little trouble adjusting," Shyla said, "but the rest of us are in hog heaven. You ought to quit this dump and go to a real college."
"I'd love to find an honorable way out," Jordan said. "If I just quit, my father would never pay my way to another college. The problem is that there's no real honorable way out of the Citadel except with a diploma."
"Well, think of something," Shyla said. "Jack needs a friend. Who'd have thought the big fellow would be lonely on a campus chock full of 10,000 people?"
"Jack's shy," Jordan said. "It'll take him a while to get his feet on the ground." A voice above us said, "Cadet Elliot?" The three of us looked up to see a Citadel upperclassman standing above Jordan. Jordan immediately stood up at strict attention and entered into a semi-brace, much to the consternation of the cadet.
"Not here, Elliot. At ease, mister. I'm eating dinner with my parents, and I couldn't help but notice you unfastened the zipper on your dress blouse when you sat down. That's an upper-class privilege."
"I wasn't aware of that, sir."
"Report to my room 10 minutes before taps, smackhead," the cadet whispered, then smiled as he looked down at Shyla. He was about to introduce himself when I grabbed him hard by the ear and jerked his head down toward me.
"Hey, acne breath," I said into the boy's ear. "I'm a patient in the state mental hospital on Bull Street. I killed my mother by stabbing her in the eye with a butcher knife. I never have to want to come looking for you, but if my cousin Jordan ever tells me to..."
I lifted a steak knife off the tablecloth.
"Let him alone, Jack," Jordan said.
"I'm very sorry, sir. My cousin doesn't get out of the hospital very often."
"I'm his nurse, cadet," Shyla said. "I hope he didn't frighten you. We'll have to increase his medication."
I released the frightened sergeant, who said,
"Thanks, Elliot. Forget about reporting to me. Enjoy your evening."
"Thank you, sir," Jordan said.
"Are you sure you wouldn't like to join us, sir?"
"My mother didn't suffer," I said. "She died instantly."
As the cadet hurried back across the darkened room, Jordan said, giggling,
"His name is Manson Summy, and he's the meanest son of a bitch in the Corps. He eats knobs for breakfast and brags about how many he's run out of the Corps this year."
"Let him run you out. Come to Carolina," Shyla said. "We've got dormitories full of girls who just lap you up like cream. There's liquor, parties galore, big band music."
"Then why's Jack so lonely?" Jordan asked, reaching across through the candlelit gloom and squeezing my wrist.
"Because he's Jack," Shyla said. "He thought we'd all grow up, and you, me, Capers, Mike, Ladere, and him would all live in one great big house."
"What's wrong with that?" I said. "Sounds like heaven to me," Jordan said, inhaling deeply as his steak arrived from the kitchen.
"It's impractical," Shyla said. "It shows no imagination."
"It shows good taste, Shyla," I said. "I know who my friends are."
It took Jordan Elliot another month of the plebe system before he decided he had a solution fantastic enough to get himself expelled from the Citadel, but in such a way that he could leave with both his dignity intact and his father's blessing. His father had believed that the Citadel would harden his son in those places that his mother had made soft in her husband's absences. What the general demanded was that the school do what he failed to do, make Jordan unlike his mother in every way. The plan Jordan devised required the help of his friends at the University of South Carolina, and made clear that Jordan had already developed his natural gift for strategic planning. Clear vision was an old habit of his, and the stress of the plebe system only strengthened his proficiency at making correct decisions on the spur of the moment. 2 weeks before the annual Citadel Furman football game, 10 Citadel cadets had taken a weekend leave and kidnapped the sleek Arabian horse that served as Furman's mascot.
The horse was a docile animal, beautifully proportioned and easily handled, but in the cadet's haste to make off with the Furman paladin, the horse was accidentally blinded by two cadets far too drunk to be loading a strange horse properly. When the cadets realized how serious the injuries to the mascot really were, they did what they considered the humane thing and put the horse down with a single pistol shot to the brain. One cadet made an error of judgment by spray-painting the word Citadel on the dead animal's body. Before this incident, Furman and the Citadel had been bitter rivals indeed. Afterward, the Citadel represented and embodied everything demonic and unspeakable in the modern world to this pretty, Baptist-governed college, which sat in the rolling hills outside of Greenville. The once placid and genteel student body of Furman rose up in sheer, barbaric fury when the news of the atrocity spread across campus. A photograph of the slain horse was on the front page of every newspaper in the state, and, fearing reprisals, the president of the Citadel, General Nugent, restricted all cadets to the campus until after the Furman game was over. Several Furman fraternities pledged to hang the Citadel Bulldog at half-mast on the state capitol flagpole in honor of the slain paladin. Jordan Elliott's first sergeant, Manson Summey, was visiting his girlfriend at Furman on the Sunday morning when the dead paladin's picture appeared in the Greenville Morning News. After kissing his girl goodbye at the entrance to her dormitory, 50 Furman boys, including half the football team, met Manson at his car. When they returned Manson Summey to the Citadel campus 2 days later, they had shaved Manson's head and genitalia, dressed him in girls' panties, and covered him with chicken shit and chicken feathers they had gathered from a local farm in Greenville. They painted the word Furman on 6 buildings on the Citadel campus, including the chapel. The cadets vowed revenge when Manson was found, chained and badly beaten up, lying in the middle of the parade ground. But General Nugent, after a conference call with the governor and the president of Furman, restricted all of his cadets to their rooms and stationed guards around the campus to prevent further incursions by Furman students. Tensions between the schools heated up to dangerous levels, and both football teams vowed to win the game that would take place in Charleston the following Saturday. Great male energy, undirected and captious, was loose in the air, and the Citadel campus felt like a small, warlike principality that was under siege. The word Furman had become an expletive among the aroused cadets, for whom the beating and humiliation of Manson Summey had erased all memory of the death of Furman's horse. Then freshman Jordan Elliott went to his company commander, Pinner Worrell, with a brilliant plan that combined military strategy with a biblical sensibility for vengeance. The plan was simple but cunning, and Cadet Captain Worrell agreed to sponsor it and even participate in it if Jordan could convince 3 non-Citadel people to drive the getaway cars. Jordan assured his commander that he had lined up the 3 drivers perfect for an operation that combined a love of fast driving and a passion for taking risks.
"Can they keep their mouths shut, Elliot?" Cadet Worrell asked.
"I'd trust them with my life, sir," Cadet Elliot assured him.
"But you're a knob, Elliot, the lowest form of waste product, a wet dream, a used Kotex, an asswipe. There will mostly be upperclassmen on this project, the creme de la creme, veritable gods, Elliot, veritable gods."
"Sir, I'd trust the lives of veritable gods with these 3 friends, even a used Kotex like me."
"I'll be responsible for all military and strategic aspects of this top-secret mission, dumbhead. Next year, I'll be in Vietnam killing gooks, plundering villages, pacifying the countryside, and generally kicking quite a bit of Asian ass. You, Elliot, will be responsible for transportation only. You're only a nobule, a sperm cell of a true Citadel man. I'll teach you everything you need to know about the subtleties of military genius."
"Sir, leave the transportation up to me."
On the Wednesday night before the Furman game, 15 cadets from G Company, dressed in fatigues, gathered to hear last-minute instructions from Pinner Worrell. For the 5th time, he walked them through each step of their commando raid on the campus of Furman University. Each squad was required to paint at least 3 buildings before hustling to the rendezvous point for the rapid trip back to Charleston before reveille sounded. Timing was essential in this mission, he repeated over and over. The 15 cadets synchronized their watches as Pinner went through their assignments once more.
They had already loaded paint cans, brushes, wire cutters, and liquor into the three cars now parked and waiting in Hampton Park, just off the Citadel campus. When the bugles echoed through the barracks at 10:30, the 15 of them were standing at a side gate. They sprinted out the gate together, and as they passed a junior sergeant, they shouted, "All in," running past him into the darkness, and raced for the railroad tracks behind the military science building. The cadets had to be back at the Citadel for morning reveille at 6:15. The city of Greenville lay 210 miles away. With our three cars running, Capers, Mike, and I checked our watches, revved our engines, and waited for the cadets to charge through the azalea bushes that lined the railroad tracks. None of us had hesitated when Jordan had called and asked for help. For the sake of friendship, each of us loved the idea of racing our cars at full throttle from one end of the state to the other. I revved my engine as Jordan climbed into the car beside me, and his company commander, Pinner Worrell, rode shotgun. Three seniors leapt into the back seat, yelling, "Go, go, go!" Capers' Pontiac GTO took off first, burning rubber, followed by Mike's 57 red Chevrolet, which Mike kept in perfect condition. My car was more pedestrian, a gray 59 Chevrolet with odd tail fins that made it look grandmotherly. But it was my first car, and I loved it precisely because of its homeliness and lack of style. It was not the swiftest of the three cars, but once it hit the highway, it could cruise at high speeds with the best of them. We flew through the residential streets of Charleston at 75 miles per hour and shot up the ramp to I-26 with our radios blasting out rock music and the cadets pouring shots of liquor to give themselves courage for the task at hand. Because he was a freshman, Jordan could not utter a word, and I listened to the nervous talk of upperclassmen as I followed Mike's taillights and settled in for a hell-bent two-hour ride in which we planned to average 105 miles per hour. In less than 1 hour, we passed Columbia, a good 100 miles from Charleston, and saw the city lights in the distance to the right. As we came up upon Newberry, I saw the blue lights of a highway patrolman's car in my rearview mirror and put my foot on the brake until Worrell told me that the patrolman was a Citadel alumnus who was privy to the plan. The patrol car raced by our three cars, and with his blue light leading the way, we burst through the Carolina Pinelands as the state began its slow climb into the mountains north of Greenville. I could feel the earth itself begin to rise and turn its energies toward the coming hills. Never had I traveled at such a speed or covered so much ground as we did rocketing through the state of South Carolina, escorted by a highway patrolman wearing a Citadel ring. When we passed by the exit to Clinton, I caught a brief glimpse of a flashlight blinking on and off quickly above us on the overpass. Far ahead, on the overpass in front of us, I saw a single flickering answering light that was so swift I was not even certain I saw it. It registered on me dimly that this was a signal of some sort, but I was concentrating so hard on my driving I did not even remember it until later the next day. As we neared Greenville, Pinner Worrell took the cadets through their paces again, step by step, making sure that each member of his team knew his role perfectly. "Wig, you've got the library. Just paint the words Bulldog and the Citadel on the front. Don't bother about the back. The same goes for all of you. Everybody be back here at exactly 0300 hours. Do you read me, gentlemen? Dumbhead, do I make myself understood?" "Sir, yes, sir," Jordan said. "You get the girls' dorm, wastewad," Worrell said to Jordan. "No sniffing underwear hanging on the clothesline." "I'll try to control myself, sir," Jordan said, and the upperclassman in the back seat laughed. "Galdi knob," Worrell said, but with brotherly affection, as we turned off the interstate when we saw the road sign for Furman University. "What's your job, Pinner?" one of the faceless cadets in the back seat asked. "The commander of the team always takes the toughest job for himself," Worrell said. "I'm spray painting on the church the words, 'Fuck Furman's dead paladin. The Citadel's glad we killed it.'" "You're nuts, Worrell," a voice said admiringly. "Pure psycho." "Thanks," Worrell said. "Thanks so much. That's what's going to give me the edge in Nam. It's guys like you who paint the dorms, but only Worrell would think to paint the church on a Southern Baptist campus." "But you're a Baptist, Worrell." "I'm a pure fighting machine, Dobbins," Worrell corrected, "and this is a fucking war."
As I pulled up behind Mike's car beside the 9-foot chain-link fence that surrounded the Furman campus, Worrell said, "You'd have made a hell of a Citadel man, McCall. What a shame to lose a man like you to a pussy school like Carolina. Let's go, men. Absolute precision now. Military precision. Our plan's flawless. Only human error can fuck this up. And gentlemen, in Worrell's army, there's no such thing as human error." The cadet team in Capus's car had already cut a large hole through the fence with wire cutters, and the first of the camouflaged cadets, carrying backpacks full of cans of spray paint, were already sprinting toward the Furman buildings, 3/4 of a mile away. The cadets were in splendid shape, their bodies honed and conditioned by long hours of running obstacle courses and quick timing with chanting platoons. When I threw the trunk open, I marveled at the speed and economy of the cadets as they slid into their backpacks, then sprinted toward the hole in the fence, where they low-crawled through the opening. The moon, which had been behind a covering of clouds, sprang suddenly free and bathed the cadets in light as they raced across the low hills, silent and swift as brook trout. I watched Pinner Worrell disappear over one of the hills and was surprised to find Jordan Elliott coming out of the shadows behind me, laughing.
"You're going to get in big trouble, Jordan," Capers said.
"Not as much as they are," Jordan said. "At least not yet." Jordan pointed to his right, and a flashlight clicked on twice, then was answered by a light to the left.
"Who's awake at this time of the morning?" Mike asked.
"The whole Furman campus. You remember Fergus Swanger?"
"Pulling guard for Hanahan High. Hell of a football player," Mike said.
Jordan pointed toward another flash of light off to the east. "Fergus plays for Furman now. I called him the other night."
"What for?" Capers said. "You don't even know the poor son of a bitch."
I told him every detail of the plan to paint the Furman campus.
"You rotten, lousy bastard," Mike said. "That's brilliant."
"But it's so two-faced," Capers said. "I really got to like those guys I drove up here."
"Then transfer," Jordan said.
"Now you get out of here fast. If they find out you drove us, there won't be anything left of your cars except the aerials and the ashtrays."
"Why?" Capers said. "Why'd you do this?"
"I had a classmate who sat at the same mess with me. We were lucky enough to get to eat with Mr. Pinner Worrell, except Mr. Worrell didn't want to waste any of the Citadel's good money by feeding a knob. So he starved us. But he had this game he played. He found out what foods we hated. I hate Brussels sprouts, so when he asked if I would like a serving of Brussels sprouts, I said, 'No, sir.' He made me eat every Brussels sprout on the table. This kid, Gerald Minshew, declined to drink tomato juice, so Worrell made him drink 12 glasses of tomato juice. What Minshew neglected to mention was that he was allergic to tomato juice. He almost died in the emergency room."
"What's the real reason for all this, Jordan?" Mike asked. "I'm not buying this hatred for Brussels sprouts and love for poor Minshew."
"I gotta get out of this school. It's not for me. I hate everything about the place except for going to sleep, and then I dream about the place."
"Just leave," I suggested.
Jordan laughed bitterly. "I told you, Jack. I've begged my father to let me resign, but he won't hear of it. Mom tells me I've got to find an honorable way out of the Citadel, or I have to stay here for 4 years.
"You call this honorable?" Capers said. "Those guys are going to get the shit kicked out of them."
"So am I," Jordan said, slipping down and crawling through the hole in the fence. Only he headed west around the fence instead of following the path of the other cadets.
"Just come back with us," I said. "These Furman people will kill you."
"If they don't, then everyone will know I made the call," Jordan said. "Hey, thanks, guys. I'll never forget what you did for me tonight. Now take off before they catch you."
As Jordan disappeared over a hill, a huge roar went up 100 yards in front of us as 500 Furman boys executed a perfect double envelopment movement that cut the Citadel cadets off from their escape route. Some signal had been given, and the campus bloomed suddenly with light, and what seemed like thousands of Furman men, hidden in strategic points around the campus, closed in and overwhelmed the surprised and desperately outnumbered cadets. I found myself so mesmerized by the fierce virility of this howling mob that I nearly did not make it back to my car as a contingent of Furman baseball players, armed with bats, ran toward the parked cars. We leapt behind the driver's wheels and gunned the cars down the dirt road as Louisville sluggers flew over the fence in a deadly volley, caving in my hood and breaking Mike's rear window. At an all-night gas station on I-26, we stopped for gas and to regroup.
"What was all that shit about?" I asked.
"We should be ashamed of ourselves for leaving those cadets behind," Capers said.
"You're right, Capers," I said. "Go back and pick yours up as scheduled."
"You don't know what brotherhood is," Capers said. "You're not joining a fraternity."
"Teach me all about brotherhood, fraternity boy," I said. "Go back for those cadets."
"Jordan used us," Capers said.
I shook my head and said, "Jordan's our friend and we stand by him."
"My God," Mike said. "He does things no one would ever think of."
"He's dangerous," Capers said.
"So far," Mike said, laughing, "only to Citadel cadets."
And dangerous he was to those valiant, rough-and-ready cadets who made the journey to Furman that autumn night. 16 cadets slipped onto the Furman campus that night, and none walked off campus on his own power. One cadet was lassoed out of an oak tree and pulled down to the ground, where he was stomped half to death by a Furman mob. Pinner Worrell's jaw was broken and 3 ribs cracked as he tried to spray-paint the line of attackers who felled him. His was one of 3 broken jaws recorded by the emergency room at the Greenville County Hospital. 7 of the cadets came to that hospital unconscious, including Jordan Elliott. Jordan was also the only cadet to reach a single Furman building to desecrate it with the words, "The Citadel." He was spray-painting those words on the gymnasium when he was sighted by a roving patrol of paladins who gave the alarm. Soon, Jordan was in a foot race with Furman boys that he was destined to lose. He ran toward the tranquil lake that he had noticed on the map that Worrell had marked when they planned the mission. Feeling the mob almost upon him, he did a speed dive into the cold November waters and began stroking the Australian crawl as hard as he could toward the distant shore. Behind him, he heard 5 or 6 of the Furman boys enter the water and howl with displeasure as the cold bit into them. Since he could swim like an otter, Jordan had several fleeting moments of hope when he thought he might elude his pursuers. Then he heard the sound of 4 canoes launched simultaneously in the water, and looked back to see the canoes loaded with 4 beefy paddlers each, stroking in unison toward him. Laughing, Jordan turned to face them in the water. When the first canoe closed on him, he dove underwater and managed to tip it over, but an oar struck him in the back of the head, drawing blood. Before he felt himself sinking beneath the black water, he saw the shadows of the paddles coming from everywhere, in slow motion, again and again and again. Jordan's concussion was severe, and he was the last cadet to be released from the Greenville County Hospital, and returned, under guard, to the Citadel. Like the others before him, he was expelled for conduct unbecoming a cadet, and while he was escorted to his room to pack his belongings, the cadets of Paget Thomas Barracks gathered along the railings and cheered so loudly and for so long at Jordan's departure that even the fury of General Elliott was appeased by the final triumphant hurrah the Corps extended to his son. For the rest of the semester, Jordan lived with his parents at Camp Lejeune. In January, he matriculated at the University of South Carolina, where I had spray-painted the words, "Go Furman," on the doorway leading into our dormitory. Chapter 33. On the first day of June, Lucy telephoned and asked if I would come over and visit with her alone. Her voice alarmed me, and I had a sudden premonition of bad news. When I arrived, she told me that the night before she had awakened in darkness and felt a slight, an almost imperceptible change in her body, like the tiny rustle of cylinders shifting in a combination lock. She had always been able to read the signals her body gave off, and had known each time she was pregnant, long before her doctors confirmed her intuition. Last night, lying drenched in her own sweat, she knew that the cells that would kill her had returned. The leukemia was on the move again, she said, and this time it had come to stay. Though I had seen my mother weep before, I had never seen her cry over her own mortality. She had done everything the doctor said for her to do, yet a death sentence had been passed on her. I do not think that her tears were out of self-pity, although that was my first thought as I sat there in my role of dumbstruck witness. As she cried, I began to understand. You weep at the loss of so beautiful a world, and all those parts you will never be able to play again. The dark takes on different meaning. Your body has begun to prepare you for the last completion, for the peace and generosity of silence itself.
I watched closely as my mother tried to imagine a world without Lucy Pitts. At first, it was beyond imagination, but her tears helped water the path. The idea of it tempted her at the center of where she lived. By weeping in front of me, Lucy was taking the first step toward dying well. A better son would have embraced his mother and comforted her, but my body was shy when it came to all the common intimacies of touch. I put my hand out toward her shoulder, then withdrew it as soon as I came in range of her body. Her grief seemed to make her dangerous, electric, but behind it, an ancient code sounded its own venture of resignation. Again, I reached out toward my mother, but my hand did not travel the distances that had suddenly grown up between us. In the heat of this morning, I felt a film of ice form over my own heart. Wordless, I tried to find the words that would bring peace to my mother. Knowing that I should take her into my arms, I sat there paralyzed, thinking far too much about everything. Thus, I lost that most precious and life-defining of all moments, forever. I could not think of touch without conjuring up visions of strangulation, the breathlessness that led to the deepest realms of terror. Where other men took comfort in the arms of their women, I brought visions of the pythoness, all the swiftness and airless panic of constriction. As we sat out on her deck and listened to the waves come in, one by one, Lucy reiterated to me that she was living out the last months of her life. She said it was time to get her affairs straight, to tell the truths that needed to be told, to explain to her children that she had not abandoned us in the reeds on the day we were born, although she knew we thought she had. We had judged her unfairly and had declared her on the secret ballots we had counted behind her back to be our tenderest executioner. Because she had protected us from the horrors of her own childhood, she had not prepared us for the more commonplace suffering of our own. She had lied about who she was and where she came from because she wanted us to have a fresh start in a world that had manhandled her from the very beginning. She thought that love was the fiercest, most authentic part of her, yet feared she had never allowed it to air out properly, had kept it too tightly clenched and close to her chest. As she felt herself dying, she wanted me to know that she had loved her son so much that it had frightened her. To contain that fear, Lucy had loved us in secret, had turned that love into an eccentric form of counterintelligence that had its own passwords and codes of silence. She had covered her feeling for us with thorns and barbed wire, and had placed landmines in all the rose gardens leading to it. With outstretched arms, her children had crossed those blown-out fields again and again to reach out for her. If she had known that love had to be earned and fought for, she would have imparted that lesson to us. Only when the cancer had begun to eat away at her life did she remember the little girl she had once been. It was that same girl who brought trouble and misery to the art of loving. Love had to cross the threshold of a burning house where her father died in a fire set by her mother. Love had to tiptoe beneath the corpse of her inconsolable mother who had hanged herself from a railroad trestle. What did love feel like when its hands were bloodstained in the strands of time? I could feel my mother try to explain all this, and she struggled to find the proper words. But the language failed her, and I heard just the waves again. She was breathing hard. It was time to put her house in order, and she would try to repair the damage before she died. That was her pledge to me on the morning she told me that the leukemia had come back to take up residence in her body again, this time as a permanent guest. Dr. Pitts joined us on the deck, and I could tell that my mother had already shared the news with him. He walked over to her, fresh-shaven, dapper, and I could smell the sharp scent of his cologne in the air as he lifted my mother out of her chair and she collapsed into him. Her husband held her, and I learned something about the quiet strength of men as he whispered something to her I could not hear. Enveloped in his arms, I saw the comfort that he conferred upon my mother by merely opening himself up to her. Not one of the men in my family could have performed this vital yet very simple function. My mother buried her face against his chest, and I turned my own face away, realizing how much of an intruder I was at this moment of bittersweet intimacy. "I think we should call off the party for Lucy," Dr. Pitts said. "You can break the news to your brothers, Jack." "No,"
my mother said, drawing back from him. "That's my party. It's still going to go on."
"They wanted to celebrate your remission," Dr. Pitts said.
"No one has to know I'm out of remission," she said. "It'll be our secret. No law that you have to tell your brothers everything, is there, son?"
"No law," I agreed.
"I'll buy the prettiest dress in Atlanta," she said, kissing Dr. Pitts on the cheek. Then chilled me by saying, "It'll be the one I'm buried in."
And so my brothers and I began planning the party in honor of our mother that would take place on Labor Day, and that we had announced to the world would celebrate the fact that her leukemia had stayed in remission for over a year. As we meted out each of our assigned tasks, I was strangely comforted by the fact that none of my brothers yet knew that the white cells in her blood were on the march again. Her bloodstream had frightened all of us with its capacity for jeopardy and betrayal, and although we knew about mortality and accepted it on both an intellectual and primitive level, we had never focused on the fact that our mother might die, that she might one day leave us. Because she was so young when we were born, our mother seemed more like an older sister and confidant than she did a parent. Her complexity continued to surprise us all as we grew older, and it would have been impossible for any of us to describe her in a couple of glib, tossed-off sentences. If each of us had been compelled to do so, no doubt descriptions of five different women from various latitudes or even solar systems would have been the result. Lucy took pride in being mysterious, unplaceable, night-shaped. She had wept when we told her about the party we planned to give her. While my brothers interpreted these tears as tears of gratitude, I knew she was weeping at her son's fierce refusal to acknowledge that she was dying. Mike Hess offered to host the party and provide all the liquor at his plantation house. Dallas, Dupree, T, and I spent the week before gathering the food. What we had in mind was a day of ecstasy and jubilee, celebrating Lucy's triumph over insurmountable odds. When Dr. Peyton had called from the hospital with the results of her recent blood tests, he confirmed that she had gone out of remission. He told her she must come in to start more chemotherapy treatments the very next day. "No way, little doctor," she said. "I know my chemo now. It put a lot bigger hurtin' on me than leukemia ever did. My boys are planning a party for me, and I wouldn't miss it for the world." "Your choice, but while you're eating fried shrimp, those white cells are going to have an open season."
"I've looked up my kind of leukemia in my husband's medical textbooks. According to them, my cancer is particularly ornery, and I don't have a chance in hell of surviving, whether I get that chemo or not."
"There's always a chance, Lucy," the young doctor said.
"That same chance'll still be there after my party," Lucy said. "My boys have been planning this all summer."
"Why is this party so important to you?"
"Because it'll be the last party I'll ever attend on this good earth," she said, "and I plan to enjoy every minute of it. Please come. My boys know how to feed a crowd."
T had come up with the idea of throwing a huge, unforgettable party in praise of Lucy. Once he fastened his attention to this party in the abstract, he drove us to distraction to attend to the details that would make it a reality.
"I'm the idea man in this outfit," T told us. "It's up to you guys to bring the party favors and buy the swizzle sticks."
"How many people you thinking about inviting, idea man?" Dallas asked.
"The sky's the limit," T said.
We then told Lucy that there were no limits to the number of the people she could invite, and she took us at our word. Her heart softened even toward her enemies, and her eyes would grow dim as she told us about why she had quit speaking to certain women in the town. She pitied anyone who had not gotten to know her since she finally summoned up the courage to kick the judge out of her life. She was a harder version of herself when she spent every waking moment trying to cover up for the havoc he left in the trail of his binges and blackouts. It was not fair that her life was ending just when she had it all figured out and was moving in a straight line at last. She loved it that we had insisted on giving her the party and was moved that so many people had called to say they were coming. In the last week of August, my brothers and I got up early and went fishing for the party. T and Dupree went out on a boat in Lake Moultrie and caught the landlocked bass that grew to be huge in those chilly, man-made depths of the lake near Columbia.
Silas McCall and Max Rusoff bought a license and spent the week trolling for shrimp, even though both men had passed their 80th birthdays. They headed the shrimp themselves and iced them in seawater in quart containers. The gathering of food for Lucy's party was ceremonious, valedictory. Only Dr. Pitts and I were weighted down by the awful knowledge that the cancer would soon steal the vitality and bloom from Lucy's famously rosy complexion. We knew that she was drying up from the inside. The night before the party, on the Isle of Orion, Lucy led us down to the designated nesting grounds in front of her beach house. Here, marked with flat, rectangular stakes and rimmed with wire fencing, she and her volunteers had reburied the eggs of the mother loggerheads that had begun to lay their eggs in the warm, inert sand on May 15th. The beach erosion had been furious, with great storms devouring the sand. Four nests had washed away before Lucy informed the South Carolina Wildlife Department that she was ignoring their directive to let the nests stay where the loggerheads had laid them in the sand. The sight of turtle eggs soaked with seawater and torn open by crabs and seabirds sickened Lucy. Each gold yolk she found drying out against the shells represented another notch on the belt of extinction to her. There had been 37 nests that summer, and she and her co-workers had removed 2,074 eggs to the nursery that she could watch over from her front porch on the beach. The incubation period in the hot sands was 2 months, and even in the release of the baby loggerheads, Lucy did not see fit to obey the law to its letter. According to department rulings, if someone was granted permission to move a loggerhead's nest, which Lucy had not been granted, that individual could not touch that nest once the eggs had been reburied. The department agreed with Darwin that the laws of natural selection were paramount and should be allowed to make their own severe covenants of choice when the turtles burst from their nests and made their race for the sea. But over the years, Lucy had seen too much attrition among the ranks of the baby loggerheads that she considered wasteful and unnecessary. Once she had found 10 baby turtles stacked like tin cans in the den of a ghost crab, most of them still alive and helpless, waiting for the crab to decapitate them and dine on their heads. She had watched as raccoons moved among the turtles, fighting with the seagulls who swept down on the babies from above, biting off their small heads and dropping their shells into the shallow breakwaters. Lucy had also witnessed the turtles making it to the waterline, only to be snatched up by the wickedly swift blue crabs that waited for them in the surf, or to be devoured by small sharks and blues who waded in deeper water. Though she could do nothing about the enemies they encountered in the ocean, she devised a plan that at least gave them all a chance to make it into the sea. Every time that Lucy Pitts moved an egg that summer, she broke a South Carolina law. But almost every baby loggerhead under her protection knew the taste of seawater before it began on its journey out toward the Sargasso Sea. At sunset, the night before her party, my mother marched out of her house holding Leah's hand, and my brothers and I lined up behind her in single file. She carried a bucket and a large clamshell to dig into the undermined nest. Betty and Al Sobel, her chief assistants, were already waiting with the usual congregation of tourists and their overexcited children. The news of the turtle release program had already made it the leading tourist attraction on the island after golf. Lucy had a strict code of rules and instilled discipline into the tourists, who were careful to stay behind the demarcated area that Lucy had fenced off. "Is the nest ripe?" Lucy asked Betty Sobel.
"See for yourself," Betty answered. "They're ready to go."
Lucy waited for us to gather around her and for the tourists to arrange themselves comfortably within earshot. She took her role of teacher with great seriousness, and she had no comic side when it came to her turtles. She brought the same sense of style to the turtle program that she had brought to the story of Sherman and Elizabeth during the spring tour of homes. What she said could not be written on placards, but there was a sincerity in her voice that was authentic, bankable. Before the development of the Isle of Orion, hundreds of loggerheads once made their nests on this same beach. The story was the same for many species of animal all over the world before the great, slow-footed dance of extinction gathered speed as man continued to poison and lay waste to everything he loved the best.
She pointed to the nest they would uncover that night, and told the children to note that the sand had fallen into a soft funnel, which meant the turtles had broken their shells and had begun to dig themselves out. They were interfering with this process, Lucy explained, because she wanted to give the most turtles the greatest possibility to survive the dangerous voyage ahead. The children groaned when Lucy told them that only one of these turtles would survive long enough to come back to this same beach to lay her eggs.
"Most of us will be dead when that lone turtle returns," Lucy said. "I want some of you children to promise me that you'll come back each summer to help make sure these turtles will continue to survive. Promise me. Raise your hands."
Leah's hand shot up first, followed by those of every child who stood attentive in that quasi-military semicircle. Noting the unanimity, Lucy nodded, then sank to her knees and studied the contours of the nest they would excavate that night.
"Dig with your hand tonight, darling," she said to Leah, who began to take handfuls of sand from the deepest point of the inverted V.
When she took out her fourth handful of sand, she was holding a wriggling, electric body of a small turtle.
"Keep a strict count," Lucy warned. 119 eggs were in this nest.
Lucy took the first turtle, examined it to see if it still had egg yolk attached to its abdomen, then placed it in her bucket.
"One," Leah said, and then she brought out two more turtles and handed them to her grandmother, as children squealed and pressed forward.
Lucy studied each turtle for signs of the egg yolk, which would drown them if it were still on their shells when they were placed in the ocean. A little blonde girl broke loose from her mother and asked Lucy if she could hold one. Lucy placed it in the 5-year-old hand and asked,
"What's your name, sweet roll?"
"Rachel," the child answered.
"Put it in the bucket. This turtle's named Rachel."
"Is it mine?" the girl asked.
"That's your turtle," Lucy answered. "Yours forever and ever."
Leah brought up 96 turtles that were ready to make their walks to the sea that evening. 23 were still weighted down with yolk that would need to absorb before they tested their strength against the Atlantic. Leah buried those turtles again in the same sand she had removed. She smoothed it flat with the palm of her hand and covered it with wire to prevent the raccoons from making a mid-morning raid. The crowd followed Lucy and Leah down to the beach, 50 yards away. With the shaft of a damaged, headless 5-iron, Lucy drew a large semicircle in the sand that she told the crowd they could not pass beyond. The tourists spread out along that drawn perimeter and watched closely as Leah tipped over the bucket and those 96 turtles boiled out and made their first struggling efforts to reach the sea. The tide was coming in and running strong to the north as those tiny loggerheads, afire with sudden life, each the size of a silver dollar and the color of unshined military shoes, fanned out in careless disorder, each one enclosed in the sudden responsibility of its own destiny. The crowd began to cheer, urging the turtles onward as they made their halting, unskilled way toward the roaring surf. One turtle led the way, breaking far ahead of the pack, but all of them moved in the same direction.
"How do they know to go toward the ocean?" a young mother asked.
"Scientists say the light," Lucy explained.
"What do you think?" the mother asked.
"These are South Carolina turtles, like my boys here," Lucy said, smiling at us. "I think they listen to the waves. I think they just love beach music."
When the first turtle hit the first wave, it tumbled upside down and righted itself quickly, undeterred. It had felt the element it was destined to join, and when the second wave hit, that turtle was swimming. Pure instinct drove those tiny turtles toward the surf, as the topography and smell of that beachhead imprinted themselves forever in their newly hatched, primitive brains. Once they had made this walk to the sea, you could take those loggerheads on a spaceflight to Mars, return them to the Lido of Venice, and they would still make their way back to the Isle of Orion to lay their eggs. In them, the homing instinct was a form of genius. As each turtle reached the water, I could see the joy in Lucy's face. She never tired of watching the little creatures struggling over the sands until they reached the sea. Once in the water, they took off like young buntings in first flight.
She watched as their tiny, snake-like heads appeared on the surface of the wind-driven sea, to take in a pinch of air, then resume their glorious and perilous journey. Her happiness was an earned pleasure that she could share with strangers. "Leah," she said, reaching for Leah's hand again, "every time I see this, I feel like I've discovered God all over again." A young mother who had red hair approached Lucy and said, "This is against the law, isn't it? I read an article recently that said that man should let nature work in its own way." "Then nature wants the loggerhead turtle to die out," Lucy said. "Then that is God's will," the woman said. "It might be, but I sure as hell don't agree," Lucy said. "You'd go against God's will?" the woman, who wore a gold cross on her necklace, said.
Lucy answered, "It won't be the first time the two of us have disagreed. This is the third night you've been with us for a turtle release."
"No, it's my fourth," the red-headed woman said, looking away from the beach toward the line of houses.
"Stay for Labor Day," John Harden said to the woman. "We're giving my mother a big party. Everyone's invited."
"I won't be here that long," the woman said, as Lucy saw revolving blue lights reflected in the woman's pupil. "In fact, I've got to leave now." "You shouldn't have called the cops," Lucy said. "I try to help the turtles have a fighting chance." "You break the law," the woman said. "I have a degree in biology. You're interfering with the natural process."
"Lady, you called the cops on my mother," John Harden said, blocking the woman's escape route.
"Kill her, John Harden," T said.
"Shut up, T," Dupree warned, moving between John Harden and the woman. "Easy now. This can all be explained." "My mother's got leukemia, lady," John Harden said, his anger growing as the police drew closer. "You think going to jail's going to help my mother fight cancer?"
"No one's above the law," the woman said.
"How many years in prison will I get if I kill this woman, Dallas?" John Harden asked.
And now some of the other tourists began to murmur among themselves, and one woman shouted for the police to hurry.
"It wouldn't count as premeditated murder," Dallas said. "You went wild after the lady arrested your mama, who was dying of cancer. I think you'd probably serve 3 years with time off for good behavior."
"My boys are big pranksters, honey," Lucy said to the terrified woman.
"But I've spent half my life in the insane asylum up in Columbia," John Harden said. "Surely a jury'd have pity on a poor schizophrenic."
"Cut it out, John Harden. Quit egging him on, Dallas."
"Relax, honey. Go on up to my house and fix yourself a drink," Lucy said, and she waved a finger of warning at the rest of us as the sheriff approached, accompanied by the young woman who worked for the wildlife department.
"My, Sheriff," Lucy said, "what are you doing out here on a pretty night like this, when hunters are out killing deer out of season, and good old boys are staked out all over these creeks baiting for shrimp?"
"Got a complaint about you, Lucy," Sheriff Littlejohn said.
"I've got a drawer full of complaints about you, Lucy," the wildlife officer, Jane, said. "But Lucy insists that she knows better than any law enforcement could."
"If you know so damn much, explain why the loggerhead's an endangered species," Lucy said.
"As your attorney of record, I advise you to remain silent, Mother," Dallas said.
"Mama, are they going to arrest the turtle lady?"
a little girl cried out. "I've been doing this same job for years, the same damn way," Lucy said. "They keep changing the rules on me."
"I've got a warrant for your arrest, Lucy," Sheriff Littlejohn said.
"Hey, Sheriff, Mom's sick. She's not going to spend the night in jail," I said.
"I went to school with you, Littlejohn," Dupree said. "You flunked English." "I got a D," Littlejohn said. "Who's got a tire iron?" John Harden said to the crowd. "I'm going to beat this red-headed woman down to crab bait."
"You heard him, Sheriff," the woman said. "He threatened me in earshot of the law itself."
"He's got more voices talking in his head than a TV set," the sheriff said. "Pay no mind."
"What law was broken, Sheriff?" Dallas asked.
"No one's allowed to go into a turtle nest," the sheriff said.
Jane from Wildlife said, "She helps them get to the ocean. That's against the rules."
"My mother didn't touch a nest tonight," I said. "You've got a beach full of witnesses. My daughter and I dug up that nest. Isn't that true?"
The crowd murmured its assent.
"And I'd be pleased to arrest you, Jack."
"But she supervised the whole thing,"
the red-headed woman said. "She was definitely in command."
"Cuff me, Little John," Lucy said, playing to the crowd. "It'll be front-page news across the state."
A man's voice rang out behind the sheriff.
"Leave my wife alone, Little John."
It was Dr. Jim Pitts, who had run down from the screened-in porch to see what the disturbance was.
"They were making pancakes and waffles from these turtles' eggs when we got to the island. Lucy's changed all that."
"Get back to your houses, people," the sheriff called out to the crowd, but they refused to disassemble and remained clustered and aggravated, waiting to see how the confrontation would resolve itself.
"She sacrifices everything for these damn turtles," Dr. Pitts said. "Everything."
"We are not saying she hasn't done good work in the past," Jane said.
"I dug up all the turtles, Sheriff," Leah said. "I put them in the bucket and I carried them down here near the beach. My grandmother didn't do one thing."
"That's right," people in the crowd said.
"If anyone touches you, Mama, I'll kill them with my bare hands," John Harden said, moving between the sheriff and his mother.
"The arrest warrant's got your name on it, Lucy," Sheriff Little John said.
"Let me just go down to the jailhouse," Lucy said. "Come with me, Dallas, and bail me out of there."
"Trust a goddamn lawyer in this country?" John Harden said. "After Watergate, I wouldn't trust one of you bastards to read out a phone number from the men's room."
"Shut up, John Harden," Dupree said. "You sound like you need a shot."
"A man expresses a simple opinion, Dupree, and you call for Thorazine."
Sheriff Littlejohn ended the discussion by cuffing Lucy's hands together in a single, economical movement that caught everyone by surprise. Lucy took two steps toward the squad car, the sheriff firmly gripping her elbow. Then Lucy interfered with the arrest by fainting headfirst into the sand in front of her. Dr. Pitts lunged toward her and lifted her head out of the sand as John Harden tackled the red-headed lady and wrestled her to the sand. My brothers pulled John Harden off, but he punched T in the mouth and kicked Dallas squarely in the genitalia as the crowd began shouting so loudly that someone sitting on their dock up the beach went in and alerted security at the Isle of Orion Gate. When the sheriff fired a single shot in the air to restore calm, Dr. Pitts screamed loudly and commanded that everyone step back and allow Lucy room to breathe. Sheriff Littlejohn sighed, then bent down and unlocked the handcuffs that bound Lucy's wrists together. Lucy looked as frail as any shell that lay strewn and storm-tossed on the beach. Dr. Pitts had tears running down his face, but they were fierce tears of anger, not sorrow. Though he tried to speak, fury disbanded any words, and he stammered over the body of his wife. "The stranger who had married my mother," I thought once more, "loves her far more deeply than any of us realize."
"Rape, murder, pillage, drugs, and mayhem all over Waterford County," T screamed, "and the high sheriff of the Low Country boldly arrests our mother, an environmentalist with leukemia. Good work, Little John, you silly-ass loser of the 20th century."
The crowd slowly divested itself of a shape, drifting like smoke into the gentle last light, a moon sneaking a forehead above the waterline to the east. I knelt down and lifted my mother up into my arms and began walking back to her house. Still trying to find words, Dr. Pitts trailed behind us, and Dallas picked up Leah and rode her on his back, following our lead. In the house, Dr. Pitts exploded after I had taken Lucy to her bedroom, and she had recovered strength enough to take a sip of water and change into her nightclothes before she fell asleep.
"I have something to say to you boys," Dr. Pitts began as he poured himself a tumbler full of scotch. "I know you love your mother, and I know she loves you, but you'll kill her faster if you don't get control of yourselves. All of you need to learn to be part of a room without filling it up. You need to learn to be in a scene without being the whole scene. You don't need to be the funniest, the wildest, the craziest, the weirdest, or the loudest person on earth to get Lucy's attention. She loves all of you. But there's too much commotion around you boys. I demand that you quit turning every single thing into an event. Everything is over the top when you guys are around. Learn to relax, to muse things over, to look at things calmly and at a normal pace. Why is that impossible with you McCalls? Why must every day seem like a home movie from the apocalypse? Your mother needs rest from all this. She needs quiet. And tomorrow, you're giving her a party and the whole town's invited. Everybody.
I haven't met a single soul who isn't invited to Lucy's party. Black, white, everybody in town is called to RSVP for tomorrow, and even Lucy doesn't know half of them. Things move from an event, then a spectacle, then an extravaganza. You attract noise and disorder. You're all in love with what's bad for Lucy. You're killing her. You boys are killing what you can't stand to say goodbye to.
I agree with Dr. Pitts, John Harden said. You guys are just scumbags and shouldn't be allowed near Mama.
Why don't you write a Dear Abby column for fruitcakes, John Harden? Dupree said.
You had the worst grades of any of the brothers by far, John Harden lashed back. The only job you could hold down was locking up crazy people.
No harm in that, Dupree said. I get to spend all my time around wonderful guys like you.
What a low-life criminal-type loser you are, John Harden said to Dupree, making a mockery of the mentally ill.
You two are scaring Leah, Dallas suggested quietly. Jack's raised her to think that life is full of teddy bears, free pizza, and photos of the Tooth Fairy. She's been vaccinated to fight off the full horror of being a McCall.
Listen to you. Here it goes, Dr. Pitts said. Each one of you takes it to a higher and higher pitch. Can you shut up? Can you shut your mouths now and let my poor wife sleep?
Shall we call off the party? T asked Dr. Pitts.
Your mother would never speak to me again if I called off her party, Dr. Pitts said, rising and moving toward his bedroom. Help me make it go smoothly, boys. Please, I beg of you.
Hey, Doc, Dupree said seriously. Thanks for loving our mom. It's nice of you and we appreciate it.
She's had a hard life, I said, and she hardly got a single break. But Mom said that you are the best thing that ever happened to her.
When Lucy rose the next morning, refreshed and vibrant, she referred with delicious irony to our party for her as the Last Supper. She put on a party dress that she had bought at Saks Fifth Avenue in Atlanta and a broad-brimmed hat that came from a boutique on the Via del Corso in Rome. She radiated the natural prettiness she had brought with her out of the North Carolina mountains as she watched Dr. Pitts make her breakfast and fret over her. His sweetness clearly tickled her, even though there was something school-momish and fastidious about it. His mouth was pursed constantly, as though he had just said, harumph, and his face looked like the old maid on the dog-eared pack of cards that we used to play with on those days we stayed home from school with fevers. It seemed to me that their love was based on their common need for order and mannerliness in their lives. Both had endured lives of chaos and incivility in their first marriages, and they provided each other with safe harbor at last. The town of Waterford had finally, after 40 years, grown accustomed to Lucy's way of doing things. It knew the tender-hearted, deferential Lucy as well as it knew the vulgar, unaccommodating one. 500 townspeople came to her last supper, 200 more than were invited. Lucy never stood on ceremony, and everyone in Waterford knew that her door was always open, and she always smiled in public. They all came to say goodbye to her famous smile. Mike Hess had suggested the whole affair be catered and done up right, but we had insisted on doing all the cooking ourselves. Like all of my close friends, he had fallen in love with my mother long before he ever got around to falling in love with girls his own age. When Mike gave his first interview in Premier Magazine, he told his interrogator that he first knew that small towns were the residences of goddesses, when he went to his best friend's fifth birthday party and caught a glimpse of Lucy McCall. Mike had spent so much time at my house, as much because of Lucy's good-natured flirtatiousness with young boys as his closeness to me, and I always knew it. Lucy was one of those charismatic mothers who took the time to listen and counsel her children's friends, and, by so doing, influenced all of us, for better or worse, who were lucky enough to be around her. The Red Clay Ramblers set up on the riverbank and played their sweet music for hours at a time. Senator Ernest Hollins held court on one side of the huge expanse of grassy yard that led from the back of the house to the water, and his Republican counterpart, Strom Thurmond, kissed the hands of every lady in sight as the air filled up with the smell of a feast bad for the arteries and good for the soul. Dupree had a pot of Frogmore stew simmering near the line of picnic tables, and I could smell the pork sausage mingling with the fresh corn and shrimp,
cutting the air with its special tang of barnyard, field, and saltwater creek. Opposite me stood Dallas, dressed in jeans and shirt, shoveling oysters onto tin sheets spread over cinder blocks and heated by a fierce wood fire. He would place the oysters with great precision, evening up their exposure to the heat, until they would pop open from the force of their own interior steam and spill their fragrant juices onto the tin. Then Dallas would shovel the opened oysters onto picnic tables covered with newspapers, and the perfume of those washed-down mollusks gave off a silvery, slightly metallic musk of a rained-on acre of spartina. T and the sisters-in-law served platefuls of barbecue, which glistened in a mustard-based sauce that made the pork look like it had been painted with gold leaf. Three open bars had the crowd garrulous, and ice chests full of beer were packed down and there for the taking. The women had come gussied up because they knew from experience that Lucy did not know the meaning of the word casual, and would come dressed to kill no matter how hard they tried to wrestle the secret of the dress code for the party from her. Mike had been standing beside Lucy and Dr. Pitts on the veranda to make an informal receiving line that marched up the front steps,